So welcome everybody. I'm very excited to be here and I'm very pleased and honored that Ari has invited me to share our experiences on the study abroad course. And the good thing about Ari gatherings are it's such a mixed group. People from different backgrounds get together because they have an interest in some topic, and it's always nice to be able to tailor the presentation to, you know, meet different backgrounds and different interests, and it's not just purely an academic presentation. So what I want to do is I'm also very happy to see three of my students here. They were with me on the trip, on the visit, and I'm going to have them talk a little bit at the end and share their thoughts. But what I'm going to do is talk about the study abroad in India course and divide the presentation into basically three sections. I want to talk about the importance, the implementation, and then the implications of the course. The course is one study abroad course that is offered by the City College of New York Study Abroad Program. It's a large program, and every semester they offer several courses around the world. This was the first time, very first time, that a course was offered for India. And it did take a lot of thought and a lot of planning on my part to make it work. I want to thank Tatiana Klein. She's the program director of the Bilingual Education Program, and that's the program that houses this course. The course was titled Education That is Multicultural, and so thank you for giving me this opportunity. So I want to talk about the importance first. And so why is a study abroad course important, or why is a study abroad experience important? The whole idea of a study abroad was to raise an awareness for the elements that make up any kind of culture, and so that you can uncover the unique values and beliefs that explain why people think and behave differently. And that's key. And I want you to keep that in mind. It's like the unique values and beliefs that explain why people think and behave differently. So when we see different behaviors that are other than, different from our own, many times we don't stop to think, why are they behaving in that manner? Many times we jump into conclusions saying, well, that's right or wrong. But it's just different. It's not right or wrong. It's different. And what a study abroad experience does is allows that opportunity to explore what are the underlying values and beliefs that are unique to that culture that explain the behaviors of people or individuals in that culture. So understanding culture and context is an important part. This is really why a study abroad is, is offered. A study abroad experience is offered. It's something that an opportunity where individuals can go into an experience, kind of get immersed into another cultural context to be able to understand it better. So it's very different from just touring a place. It's very different from reading about a culture. When you study abroad, it's a deeper level of immersion that happens, and that uncovers a lot more deeper values and beliefs. And I'm going to talk about the levels of culture in a minute. So before we go to the levels of culture, what is culture? So when people think of culture, they often think of artifacts like food and music and, you know, literature and art, or they may associate cultures with behaviors and values and attitudes, patterns of social interaction. So culture is a concept that is rooted in anthropology. And, some of the first original definitions of culture came out of the field of anthropology. And according to anthropologists, I'm taking a definition that's offered by Patricia Huddleston, who looks at culture as a shared set of implicit and explicit values, ideas, concepts, and rules of behavior that allow a social group to function and perpetuate itself. So it's a shared set of values, ideas, beliefs, behaviors that allows a cultural group, a cultural community, to function harmoniously and to perpetuate itself. So again, all those sections in that definition are important. It's a shared set of ideas, beliefs, behaviors, allows a community to function, but also to perpetuate itself and to move forward. But identifying a group's culture, that shared reference system, is very, very difficult. It's not a simple task. It's very difficult, very complex. And why? Because culture itself is a very complex, very multi-layered, very dynamic idea and notion. In order to explain the complexity and the multiple layers and multiple levels that comprise culture, in 1976, Edward T. Hall came up with the analogy of the iceberg and said that culture is like an iceberg. So 10% of what you see of a culture is visible, is easily observable. But 90% of what that culture is all about is invisible. It's like the, you know, culture, the iceberg below the waterline. It's very invisible. So there's an explicit surface culture and then an implicit, more indirect, more subjective, deeper culture. There are a couple of other models very similar to this, and I'm going to share those with you. But before that, here's a graphic that shows this iceberg. And if you, I know the print is small, so I'll read it out to you. But above the waterline, the explicit visible culture, you have things like literature, food, drink, games, art, music, costumes, dress, dance, language, behaviors, architecture. And if you notice, all of these elements are things that you are, that can be absorbed by your senses very quickly. So it's things that are immediately observable, immediately audible, immediately tangible. You, when you visit a community or a different country, the things that you soak in immediately form the surface of the culture, the just the 10%. And then you have below the waterline the deeper levels of culture, the implicit ideas, the more complex ideas of beliefs and norms and assumptions, expectations, space orientations, learning styles, attitudes, values, notions of friendship, notions of beauty, notions of modesty. You have notions of the self, gender roles. All of these are value-laden underlying beliefs in a culture. And to able to get to them and to be able to understand them takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. You don't get it just when you see the surface of the culture. And that's why a study abroad experience allows that opportunity for individuals to be able to absorb the deeper levels of a culture. There's another model which is very similar, again, in terms of complexities and the different layers. It's Gerald Frank, who came up with a 3P model of culture, and he talks about the different, the 3Ps as being perspectives, practices, and products. Perspectives is what members of a culture think, feel, and value. Practices, how members communicate and interact with each other. And products, it's like the products of culture, the technology, the music, the art, the food. Again, very similar, the surface culture, and then the deeper levels of culture. So while products may be easy to identify because we can often see, touch, taste, or hear them, perspectives and practices are not easily recognized because they tend to be ingrained at a deeper level in society. And unless you interact within society with people on a daily basis and step out of your role as a tourist and really immerse yourself, you don't get to that level. There are barriers. You don't get to experience that level. There's another kind of concept that Brooks says. He makes a distinction between the formal culture and then the more deep culture. And again, it's similar. The formal culture is the surface culture, the literature, fine arts, and history, and the deeper culture are the patterns of social interactions, values, attitudes, etc. Formal culture elements are easily observable across cultures. However, as the label suggests, elements of deep culture are often difficult to identify. And this is important as they tend to be value-based and deeply rooted in the psyches of individuals who make up a specific culture. That is why it's so important. That's why it's so difficult for outsiders to understand the deeper levels of culture. Because those deep levels, those ideas, those values are deeply rooted in the psyches of people who belong to that culture. So for outsiders to understand that, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. It's not easy to do that. So you have to be able to understand different cultural attitudes and different cultural beliefs, you have to put in a lot of effort and make that effort to be able to understand that. So why is this important? Why is the study abroad important? We've said it's important because it'll help us become more aware of different cultures, of a particular culture. It helps deepen our awareness. And why is all this important? Because a deeper awareness of cultural helps us develop better skills of cultural competence. Our cultural competency skills are refined and are better. And what is cultural competence? This is, there are hundreds of definitions of culture and of cultural competence and all of these ideas, but I'm using definitions that speak to me for this particular presentation, and that kind of, I think, really fit with the idea of this presentation. So cultural competence offered by Cross and Cited and Diller-Mole is a set of congruent behaviors, attitudes, and policies that come together in a system, an agency, or among professionals and enable that system, agency, or those professionals to work effectively in cross-cultural situations. And again, that's important, cross-cultural situations. So to be able to navigate a cross-cultural situation, you need a set of cultural competencies. And now, because my background is education and this course was on education, I'm going to try and make that link to education. Why is what are these cross-cultural situations in the field of education? This is when, and I'm going to say with regard to education, cultural competence is defined as the ability to successfully teach students who come from different cultures other than your own. So your cross-cultural situation as a teacher, as an educator, is your classroom, because that's where you have, in New York City, you have so much cultural diversity. That's where you encounter students from different cultures, cultures maybe similar or different from your own, and that's your cross-cultural situation. And if you want to navigate that and bridge those gaps, you have to develop that set of cultural competencies that will help you do that efficiently. So that's why the need for this cultural competence. Diller and Mole also found that culturally competent teachers are in general more effective educators. And why is this? Because of the demanding work essential to acquire the knowledge and dispositions necessary to relate to students from other cultures. Because if they've developed a set of cultural competencies, it's because they put in that immense amount of effort that was required to be able to understand another culture, the deeper levels of a culture, and to be able to open their minds to other ways of thinking and being and living. And that's why teachers who have cultural competence are actually better educators, because they're able to bridge that gap better. So that was kind of the importance of why this is why we did this and why study abroad experiences are important. And then I'm going to come to the implementation of this particular course, talk a little bit about the course description, the participants, and talk about how I tried to make it a multiple, an interdisciplinary course and looking at education from different multiple vantage points. So the title of the course was Education That is Multicultural, and it seemed perfect to be offered as a study abroad course. It's so perfect. and this course description that I provided for this particular course on the syllabus was India's a burgeoning South Asian economy and an influential player on the global stage. This course will include a general study of education within the context of urban India. Interdisciplinary perspectives on education in India will draw from history, political science, spirituality, sociology, economics, arts, and culture. The impact of globalization and contemporary issues in education that inform national policy will be examined. Course-related activities will include meetings and field trips to educational institutions and sites of historical and architectural significance, places of worship, art museums, and galleries. These field trips will provide deeper insight into contemporary life in urban India. The course will be an in-depth experience in multiculturalism and globalization. So that was a kind of course description going in. Talk a little bit about the participants. We had a very diverse group. We had 13 students, three of who are sitting right here. Thank you, Megan and Claudia and Michael. We had diverse CUNY campuses represented. So we had 13 students from three different CUNY campuses. So it was really nice to see that there was more than one CUNY college. Most of the students were from City College. We had one student from Lehman College, and then we have two students from the Grad Center, which is the doctoral degree granting institution of CUNY. We also had diverse academic levels. So amongst these 13 students, we had two doctoral students. We had, I don't know, maybe about seven or eight grad students, and we had about four undergrad students. So we had different academic levels represented: undergraduates, graduates, and doctoral students. We had diverse academic interests. So all of the students were not necessarily education majors. The majority of them were. They were getting their degrees in education, but we had an electrical engineer. We had somebody who was majoring in international development, international studies. We had somebody majoring in anthropology. We had, what else am I missing? I'm like forgetting now. But we had a variety of backgrounds, academic interests, which made the group really rich, because each student brought to the discussion ideas from their own fields and own disciplines, and that made the discussions, every discussion that we had was really very rich because of that. And then we had diverse individual cultures and ethnicities represented. So in our group of 13 students and me, 14 people, we had 12 different countries of origin represented. And it was amazing, amazing diversity within that group, which is kind of representative of what the diversity at CUNY is. CUNY has very diverse students. So the group diversity was very essential to the success of the program, because the discussions were so rich. Everybody was bringing their own perspectives, their own understandings, their own ideas about education, about inclusion, about vocational education, all of those discussions that we were having. So we tried to approach education from multiple perspectives. I tried to plan the syllabus so that we had an understanding, a general understanding of what education in urban India right now looked like. From all different angles, we looked at the policy and legislature in education. We looked at the socioeconomics in education. We looked at spirituality in education, gender and sexuality in education, vocational education. We looked at different levels, primary, pre-primary, and even some college education. And we looked at special education, inclusive education. So we tried to get a sense of what is going on in all of these areas in education. It was more like a wide, a breadth of experiences, rather than taking one topic and then delving deep into it. This was an introductory idea of this is what's going on in education right now. So the institutions we visited were several NGOs, schools, colleges, an educational policy-making institute, a skills development institute for vocational education, a school with an inclusive education program. We went to several NGOs which were working on different aspects of education, one NGO working with women's literacy, one with children in, growing up in the slums, living in the slums, very high poverty areas in urban cities in India. They're called slums. And so this NGO would go into the slums, and they opened preschools and learning centers for children who could not go to school otherwise. So we really got a good sense of different aspects in education on our various site visits. So what I'm going to do now is take you through the course by sharing some pictures and photographs and maybe a couple of videos. And I've used, students were required to write journals and also comment on blogs. And I've used what they, comments that they made to support some of these visits and some of these pictures that you're going to see. So this was a visit to a university for educational planning and administration, which was like a policy-making institute. And here we are hearing from three of the faculty members of how a very key, critical, one of the most significant recent policies in education was drafted by faculty at this institute. And that policy is called the right to education, whereby all children, 25% of an incoming class in every school across India has to be reserved for children who come from very poor families, even private schools, even the best elite private school, 25% of that incoming class has to be given to children who come from very poor families, free of charge. So this was a policy that was put into place in 2010 and actually has been made into law now, and it was passed by the Supreme Court as a right to education law, Right to Education Act. So I'm going to read out one of the comments that one of the students said. We got on the bus, headed for a seminar with faculty and students. We were treated to a delicious Indian lunch, followed by tasty tea and biscuits. All of the students and faculty at the university were very friendly, and it felt more like a family visit rather than a national university. These three professors from the university addressed our group, explaining challenges the Indian education system is experiencing and the effects of the Right to Education Act on policy. So I think from the comments you'll also get a sense of how they were, how they felt when they visited a site. It's not just what they heard, the academics of it, the technical content of the visit, but also how they were experiencing the deeper levels of culture. And I think that comes out in their comments. So because it was made into a law at the Supreme Court, we also were lucky enough to visit the Supreme Court of India. And that was a very special visit. It's not always, and it's not easy to visit the Supreme Court. You've got to go through a lot of permissions, and then you've got to security levels, and then, but we were able to. It's open to the public, but you have to go through a lot of security before your clearance, before you can get in. And this is, again, a journal reflection. I was surprised to learn that the Supreme Court is a public court and all are free to sit and observe any case after attaining security clearance. A stark contrast from the United States Supreme Court, which is rarely visited by the public. It was interesting to see how a judicial system can effectively and justly serve India's 1.2 billion citizens. India has 31 Supreme Court justices and they hear up to 80 cases a day. In the U.S. Supreme Court, the nine justices hear less than 80 cases a year. So that's kind of the difference. And that's the numbers that you begin to understand and begin to, the numbers that begin to confront you when you're in India. You're talking about huge numbers that are like mind-blowing. You know, you talk about our nine justices who hear 80 cases a year, and then you think about a Supreme Court justice in India who's listening to 80 cases a day. I mean, I don't know how they do it. But those are the challenges that people have to work with in India on a daily basis. We visited an NGO that facilitates the implementation of the RTE Act. So the RTE Act, the Right to Education Policy, has been put into place as law that all poor children from poor families can apply to go to a private school. But not everybody knows that this is a law as yet. So there's that gap between, yes, it's a law, but a family living in a slum has no idea that he has that right to education. And so a young man started an NGO with this sole purpose of trying to educate and inform as many poor families as they could. And he started an NGO, started a little startup in a little space. He had all these volunteers sitting on the floor of this tiny room on computers and laptops, making calls, telling people, calling. So one thing that cell technology is very advanced in India. And the poorest of poor have a cell phone, if nothing else. So they were making calls and informing them, do you know that your child can go to a private school here? And that was the sole purpose. That was the aim of that NGO. And we met with him. We wanted to know how he was doing it. And there was no place to sit in the office. So he walked us to the park in front of the building. And again, just to get a sense of, of how things are done. Okay, you don't have a space in the office. Doesn't matter. Let's go sit on the lawn and I'll talk to you. I'll give you a presentation sitting there. And so we all sat there and that young man was, telling us about the wonderful work that he was doing. And it was an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. We visited another NGO which works with children in the slums. And this is an NGO that is now actually a huge across India. It has expanded tremendously. One of the top NGOs that is initially develops preschools in slum areas as well as after-school learning centers. And so we managed to visit, they took us to a visit, a preschool as well as a learning center where with slightly older children. I think they were like second graders in this picture, right, guys? Yeah. So this was an amazing experience as well. You go into this a very, very poor community. And this preschool right here, it's a little room, maybe like a 6-foot by 6-foot room. And the teacher is a woman who lives in that community. And the school, this preschool, is her living room. So every morning it turns into a preschool. And there are 19 3-year-olds who are sitting there. But the amount of learning that was going on and the amount of energy, there was so much energy, there was so much passion, there was so much excitement, there was so much wanting to learn, a desire to learn, so much commitment on the part of the teacher in teaching. She had no resources, she was teaching them how to count. She took off her bangles and said, okay, and started counting with that. And which makes you realize you don't need resources, what you need is a sense of commitment, that you want to do this no matter what you have. That's what you really need to do. And I think that came through in that just one visit when we visited these places. It was just amazing. So this is a journal reflection. I learned a lot from the presenter explaining how they engage the students, their families, and the volunteers into wanting to succeed past school. I learned how they balance creativity and structure without bombarding students with so many tests as the United States does. This is very important to me as affection between teacher and students is as well. These boys were so excited to be here. I've never been in a classroom setting over where the kids are eager to learn with lack of materials and space. And this, one of our students, she picked up on that. She said, I've never seen so much excitement. It's to be in a classroom without having anything. It's not that it's like, you know, a well-equipped classroom. We visited another NGO, and this was an NGO that promotes literacy for women in marginalized communities. It was all about empowering women and educating women. And we went to their offices. They were everywhere we went, it was welcoming. They greeted us warmly. They invited us in. Everywhere we went, we were offered tea or coffee or a plate of cookies and chips. We never left without being fed. Let me put it like that. It was always, wherever we went, it was always like that. So we went to this NGO, and then it took us down to the library. They had a little small library, and this room must have been like just the size of this room. It was their library, and they had their they gave us a presentation. They had a PowerPoint, and they shared with us the work that they're doing. These images I just pulled up from their website, but this is the kind of, just to give you a sense, they're working with rural women. They go into rural areas where they work with women and help, teach them literacy skills. And what they want is to empower women, and the only way to empower women is by educating them and making them literate. A lot of these women are not literate. They cannot read and write. So it's really starting from the very beginning. So I'm going to share another journal reflection. Many rural areas in India are media blackout zones in that they have no access to local or national media outlets. To combat this, this NGO trained a group of rural women in journalism and created a newspaper that caters to these specific areas. The newspaper is completely female-operated and is distributed in 7 different regional languages. The newspaper takes a feminist perspective and is read by both men and women in the respective communities. This is powerful because one of the biggest obstacles is the ability to change the patriarchal mindsets in rural India. And because this newspaper has a feminist perspective, I mean, even these women who have basic literacy skills take that perspective, churn out this newspaper, which is read in the rural areas by men and women, and it goes a long way in helping then men understand female perspectives. So they were doing an amazing job, and one of our students who's very interested, one of our doctoral students who's very interested in women's issues, she said that I came to India to see if I could get some counter narratives because we've heard so much about women being suppressed and women not having a voice and women not being allowed to do things across India. She's saying, I came searching for counter narratives to counter that perspective of women in India. And she realized that this whole movement was a counter narrative. It wasn't just one or two women. There are NGOs like this galore that are working towards empowering women, and that itself is the counter narrative. We went to an institute that's a skills development institute and helps youth, young people who may not have gone to completed schools or not have completed or may not have gone to schools at all, to be able to develop skills that they can use then to get a job, a professional job. And this was an institute very well developed, and they offered so many courses and diplomas to youth from marginalized communities in a variety of vocations. You could get a diploma to become an electrician or a welder or a beautician, get a job in a beauty parlor or beauty salon. You could learn tailoring skills and become a seamstress or a tailor. You could become a nurse's aide. You could become a teacher's aide. Yeah.
Sorry, just a quick question. Is that a free government program, or are there costs associated?
So there are different institutes. This particular institute was something that was a combination. It was a private institute, but also funded, aided by the government. But there are many institutes like this, and some are government, completely government-initiated. Some are privately initiated. This seemed to be a combination, but more private. But the goal of this particular institute was to train 4 million youth by the year 2022. So again, the numbers that they work with, they don't talk about hundreds and thousands. They have to really say, how do we scale up into millions? Because that's the population of India. That's the numbers that people deal with in everything that they do. So this was quite something. And every class, we went to visit these classes where the training was going on, and everybody was so welcoming, and they would, you know, stop what they were doing and explain to us what they were doing, and they were just very welcoming. And they would finish their course, and by the time they finished the course, they were guaranteed that they would get a job in a restaurant or a beauty salon or, they could earn a salary, which was really important. We also looked at inclusive education and how are special needs met by educators in school settings. What is happening in the field of special education? Because that's a very young field, and it's only very recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, that there's been a very strong focus on inclusive education, and inclusive education in a broad sense, not just special needs, but also children who come from marginalized communities, from very poor families, from tribal areas. How do we get everybody, and how do we offer an education to all of them? And that's part of the national policy discourse now, but it's only very recently that it's begun, so it's a very young field. We did visit a private school that has a lovely inclusion program in place, and the director welcomed us. She said, yes, I'm happy to share with you what we are doing. And what happens is that the private schools, because they have the resources, they begin to have these initiatives, and then those get modeled by government schools and government settings. So it's a good thing when, you know, you can have something, a model put into place, which can be then imitated and then replicated in areas and schools which are not so well equipped. There always starts in the private school because of the resources. So this was a poster in the hallway. Disability is not an inability. And one of the students commented, we see the school and parents sensitize and raise awareness about children with special needs. They raise awareness for acceptance and understanding of what it means to be a child with special needs in today's community. So it was a really comprehensive program that they were offering children. It was a It went all the way to high school. It was from primary to high school. It was all the way to high school. This was something, I just included because I think it reflects one of the values, that underlying values. You go to many classrooms, many schools in Asia, actually, not just India, and you'll see shoes are taken off and left by the door. You don't, or homes, you leave shoes at the door. You don't take them inside your home or inside the classroom. And this is a very common practice. And I included it because it was just a reflection of one of the practices that are very, very valued in Asian communities. Just again, pictures of the hallways. There was a lot of art in the hallways. We visited classrooms. The walls outside of the classroom were decorated with pictures of the kids, their artwork, and pictures of famous people such as painters and presidents. I had the opportunity to see children of different ages in their classroom. But the classroom that struck me most was the social studies class. Children were very welcoming. They were willing to give up their chairs to let us sit with them. And this shows the importance given to guests. So again, another value that was reflected. Everywhere we went, the other, the outsider, the guest, the visitor, instead of being held in suspicion and not being trusted, is actually welcomed and invited and looked after. Because if you don't do that, that's actually a problem. you're supposed to do that. That is your responsibility. That is your obligation. That if somebody visits you, you take care of them. You don't hold them outside the door and say, I don't trust you. So there's that big difference. And again, it's a cultural difference. We raise our children to say, don't trust strangers. Don't talk to them. Don't go near strangers. And in India, it's the other way around. The mothers teach children, when somebody visits your house, just tell them to come in. Serve them tea or coffee. Look after them. So that's a cultural difference right there in how children are raised and how children are taught values that get perpetuated in cultural communities. So this was a classroom of three-year-olds in a primary school. Again, every school, every classroom we went to, they welcomed us. The teacher stopped and showed us around. The children talked to us. And, you know, we, again, the difference being when we visit classrooms here, I ran a nursery school, so I know the instructions I used to give parents is that when we're going to visit that classroom, make sure you don't interrupt what's going on. Make sure you don't engage with the teacher. Don't talk to the children. You will stand on one side and you can just observe what's going on. And in India, they welcomed us. Said, yeah, come on. If you have questions, just let us know. Walk around, you know, take a look. So that whole attitude is very different to the other, to the visitor. So this is something that I wanted to share with you. This was post-colonial disruptions of the Western canon. We read a lot about, we had readings on non-Western educational philosophies. We had education majors who read a lot about Western philosophers and educators and theorists. And on that course, we read about non-Western educational philosophers like Tagore, Gandhi, Krishnamurti, and Sri Aurobindo, who have very distinct bodies of work that go to define what they think about education and how education should be. And one of the students wrote, throughout my schooling experience, I have learned most content through the lens of a white male perspective. Whether it be my bachelor's degree at a local state college, master's at NYU, or my current doctoral program, my coursework has always been filled with readings from westernized male theorists. Not once throughout any of these programs, of which I always majored in education, did I ever read about educational philosophy from the East. Imagine the kind of schools that can potentially exist if pre-service teaching projects included more of these philosophies early on. Imagine the radical possibilities we are falling short of because of a narrow focus on just a westernized canon. So these were thoughts that were going on in the students as they were experiencing these readings, these observations, these site visits. So those were kind of education-related, some of the education-related institutions and sites, but we also did some other non-education-related explorations and learned about other elements of the Indian culture. There was a diversity of cuisines we tried out, and from different parts of India. You know, this is such diverse cuisines. Each state of India has its own cuisine. So, of course, it was impossible to try out everything, but we got a flavor for different kinds of foods. We had spiritual experiences. We visited the memorial of Mahatma Gandhi, which was a very peaceful, very spiritual place. We also visited some other places of worship. One of them was the Baha'i Temple, which was called the Lotus Temple. And you'll see in the distance, it's made out of white marble, and it's like a lotus flower. It's magnificent.
What city is this in that you all visited?
This is New Delhi. Yes. Oh, sorry. This is New Delhi. We were just in New Delhi. And so somebody wrote here, after our lecture, we headed out to the Lotus Temple, which was honestly so amazing. Walking into this temple that was created for all religions to be able to pray and unite under one roof. It was quite interesting to feel the peacefulness in this temple with not only us Americans, but Indians as well. I'm so used to religions forcing their beliefs on others and majority of the time making others feel as if their thoughts are wrong. In this home, everyone's thoughts were welcomed and everyone felt united. It really was beautiful. It really was, because you go into this, it's open to everybody. It's an open space where everyone sits. There are no idols, there are no altars, and you just go, and all they ask you to do is sit in silence. And you are within your own silence, you are with your thoughts, and that's all there is to it. And it was, again, I mean, it's a simple experiences, but immensely powerful for the students. We also went to several historical sites. This was one of them. It was the Qutub Minar, a tower that was built in, I think, 1192. Beautiful architecture. But there was so much, right? We couldn't cover everything. There was so much. But we got a flavor for different things. The students got a feel for Indian fabric and fashion, and they were very excited and experimental and tried on Indian clothes. We saw, this is in one instance, we were walking and we came across a flower seller who was weaving garlands with freshly picked marigolds, roses, and jasmine flowers. And students, the little strings of flowers, some of them are garlands to go around the neck, but also in India, the women wear small strings of flowers in their hair, around their, you know, in various ways. And those are called gajras. And then so a lot of our students wanted to have flowers in their hair. And then also henna, mehendi, on their hands. So they tried out a lot of different cultural things. The surface culture, right? These are the surface cultural elements. So this is, I want to give you a kind of just a little feel for what it was like on the streets of Delhi. My first impression of New Delhi was a sense of chaos. I felt very overwhelmed from the ride to the airport to our hotel with number of cars on the road, the honking, the people, the rickshaw, the motorcycles. I realized a sense of negotiation on the road with all the chaos, and that drivers had some silent codes as their way to communicate. There are no rules, but there are rules, and there are no accidents. I mean, that's the kind of surprise that, you know, you realize that there's so much chaos on the road, and yet there are very few accidents, which is like kind of a conundrum. We just couldn't wrap our heads around that. The dotted white lanes meant little to those drivers who managed to fit whatever they were driving onto a spot. A three-lane road easily becomes a five and at times six lanes. So everybody's all over the place. And just to give you a quick... All right, we'll stop with that. But sitting in a rickshaw is like going in a roller coaster on the street. It's like a one-level roller coaster, but it weaves in and out. It has no rules. It's, you know, overtaking buses on this side and cars on this side. And it's, you just hold on for dear life. That's all you can do. But it's a fun experience, right? In contrast, we did a day trip to Agra. It's another city about 3 hours drive from New Delhi, and that's where the famous Taj Mahal is. And so we couldn't leave India without having seen the Taj Mahal. And so we drove to Agra, and then, you know, it's a drive through rural areas. And so as a contrast to that urban roller coaster ride in a rickshaw, I wanted to show you. So the students wanted music in the bus, and they wanted, like, you know, dance music. So that was what was going on. It was fun. Visiting the Taj Mahal was a dream fulfilled for many of our participants. It was something that they had been wanting to do for a very long time, had always dreamed of doing, and it was a very powerful experience for them. I'll share one thought. When the Taj Mahal did finally come into view, we were all silent despite the chaos around us. There is something so indescribably majestic about the structure, and I could not help but think back to the reading for the day which outlined its history. The Taj Mahal is a testament of true love and devotion. I mean, if you don't know, it was built by a Mughal emperor, Shah Jahan, in the 1600s. In memory, as a memorial to his wife, whom he loved so much. It is like amazing love story. On our ride home, I reflected on the meaning of love and its different manifestations and circumstances. This experience made me reflect on my own standards of love and reminded me to focus on openness of heart, not just in a romantic sense, but in a holistic way. So it really made them think about what love is all about. And a lot of students in their journal reflected on this idea after visiting the Taj Mahal. What is love about? What does it mean? But from all of this, there was definitely a learning of the deeper levels of culture. There was a lot of learning that was going on, and I'm going to very quickly talk about four areas of learning that happened. One was in terms of the economy, the demonetization and the economy. So what happened this past year was India, for the second time in its entire history as a free country, demonetized. And what that means is they took certain denominations of the currency and almost invalidated them overnight. So if you had a 500 rupee bill and a 1,000 rupee bill, in 2 days, they were invalid. And whatever, you could not use them for any transactions. And if you had them on you, you had to go to the bank, explain where they came from, and then you could exchange it for other denominations. So this was the government's way of, at least what they claim, is to counter the money hoarding that was going on, the black money that people were collecting under their pillows and in their mattresses. But it really, I mean, there was a lot. It was a difficult time for people, because suddenly when, you know, this amount is invalidated and you have to stand in long lines because there's shortage, the new bills were not ready as yet, and there was a shortage of bills, free cash flow in society. It was something that Indian citizens were really struggling with in their day-to-day life. And our visit coincided with that exact time. So our students learned what it was to struggle to try and get money and cash for day-to-day spending, just like the Indian citizens were. And it was a big lesson that they learned about. And I'm going to share with some quotations with you. We also talked about women in the public sphere and why there was a gender divide, why there were special lines for women in There was, you know, a line for just women. If you want to buy tickets to some place, there's a women's, a ladies' line, a women's line, and then a general line. Trains have a ladies' compartment and then general compartments. And so they were trying to wrap their heads around as why is this gender divide there? And I'll talk a little bit more about that. Then also disparities in local and global. When we went to visit historical monuments, there was one price for the ticket for Indian citizens, and another price, a much higher price, for foreigners. And they said that's, you know, that's not right. That's, you know, a discrimination, and that shouldn't be, and there's no equality there. We talked about it. And again, we'll talk, I'll share some thoughts with you. And then lessons in scarcity of resources. How do you still do a good job even if you don't have material resources? So these were, I think, lessons that we learned at a deeper level about attitudes and beliefs in Indian culture. So the first one on demonetization, here are some students' comments about how they were struggling. India's current financial situation, I went to the bank near my, I think she said house, but I think it, she meant hotel. I went to the bank near my hotel only to find out that both ATMs were out of order. I mean, there was no cash left. There was no cash in the ATMs. How livid I was after finding this out, but because of the U.S. is a little more developed technologically, I was able to easily maneuver around the obstacle. As I stood near an ATM, oh, this was in the U.S., but, oh, yes, sorry, so in the U.S., yes, that was her experience. Now, as I stood near the ATM lines here in India and even had difficulty exchanging currency myself, I noticed the different temperaments of the people. They had a more go-with-the-flow response in comparison to my response 2 weeks ago in the U.S. This observation has allowed me to think in a more humble way when things do not go my way. I think there was just like a little more patience. Okay, so it's not working. It's not working. If we have to stand here, we have to stand there. There was a much more tolerance about the situation in her experience. Another student says, yesterday in Janpat Market, I got to experience waiting in line for the ATM along with the locals. I found myself becoming impatient after waiting for 20 minutes, but noticed everyone else seemed to be very calm. I had a conversation with a local who said she lived close by. She began to tell me these long lines for the ATM happen every day. As she began to tell me the reason for the demonetization, I noticed she did not show any frustration. It made me realize that her, along with the people of India, have accepted what has happened and are getting used to the change. Even with this downward spiral happening, the locals seem to be accepting of what has happened and are carrying on with their daily life. Another student writes, I think while it was frustrating going through everything, in a way I'm grateful because it forced me to slow down more. I wanted to and prioritize and get more creative compared to how I would normally go about a trip. It's also one of the few times where I'm not just reading about something in the paper, but experiencing a significant moment in history. Plus, it occurred on the same day as our presidential election. It's true. On November 8th, we had 9th or 8th? 8th, we had our presidential election. And the same day, the Prime Minister of India declared the invalidation of the currency in India. So it was... So these are the lessons they learn from living through those struggles and challenges along with people, rather than coming in as a tourist and then, you know, moving on. When you're part of the struggle, you learn a lot more about the culture. The status of women, so that division, that gender divide, we talked about it. And on New Year's Eve, we had students who went to, despite my telling them not to, we had students who went out to party on New Year's Eve. And they realized that it wasn't easy to be a woman there because the huge crowds, first of all, right? The crowds there, when we talk about numbers, we're talking about millions and millions of people everywhere. So you're in this huge crowd, and then men groping and feeling and pushing and, you know, the women around. So it's just, very annoying, very frustrating. And so because they had experienced that, they realized that actually having these separate lines and separate spaces for women was for the protection of the women, that they could actually ride on the train safe and free of grouping hands and be in a line without having people, men, push into them. And so it was really trying to create a space which would protect the women. And so when we talked about it and they understood it, they realized that this is not discrimination. It's actually the men who are being discriminated. Because the women had a special place, but the men didn't have a special place. So that's another way of kind of trying to understand why things are done for certain reasons. But if we go with the perspective saying we see women and men separate and we immediately come down as an evaluation and a judgment, oh, that's discrimination, without understanding why that may be, that I think can be dangerous, because then we judge cultures without really trying to understand them. So another comment was, I too was shocked to see a woman hold such a powerful position at that time. So this is talking about the medieval tower we went to, which was built in the 12th century. And there was a Mughal queen at that time, who reigned at that time, who was very powerful, Razia Sultana. And she did a lot in terms of education and for her like a local, you know, kingdom. And so the students were very surprised to see that even at that time, in the medieval times, there were women. And even after that in history, there have been women who have had powerful roles to play in positions, holding powerful positions. I was also shocked at the separation of genders at the security checkpoint, but contradictory to this, I was even more amazed at the knowledge of women ruler in India. So again, even security, there are different lines for women. Here, it's all one line. If you go to the airport security, it's all one line. There, a woman will, what is it called?
Pat you down
for security. And men have a different line and women have a different line. So there is a gender division, but I think more for the protection of the woman than trying to shun them in any way. The disparity between local and global prices, and this was a good conversation we had, a really interesting discussion, because the students picked up on this and they said, why is it so cheap for Indians and why is it so expensive for the foreigners? And so we talked about it and we said, okay, let's see. There could be two reasons for it. One is that they want to encourage local population to come and visit, you know, sites of tourism. Another reason could be, when you look at the affordability. So if you have, say, 50 rupees as a ticket price for Indians and then 500 rupees as a ticket price for say Americans, we have if you kind of try to compare it, it's 500 rupees is equivalent to how many?
Less than $10,
right? So if you compare it that way, it's 50 units of the currency that an Indian earns versus 10 units of the currency that an American earns. We don't look at it that way, right? We just say, oh, it's 500 and 100. But we have a much more higher earning power. And so if you look at it that way, it kind of makes sense that it's okay, it's fair enough. It's fair enough. And if it can help, if that money can help in the upkeep and maintenance of these historical sites, then why not? And I think students, we talked about it, and I know Megan, you also said, yeah, it does make sense.
Definitely, that's because many times people don't have the resources to go see monuments, as
right.
well as in the U.S. as well. Like many museums have their divided thing for students, and zoos do the same, so I felt that it was fair
yeah.
for that.
Thank you. Scarcity of resources, again, I'm just sharing some comments. Learning is so exciting, but even more so in the classrooms we visited at Pratham. These kids were not wearing shoes, sat on the floor in very small rooms, yet they seemed so happy and eager to answer questions or help each other out. The enthusiasm of the teachers we visited, along with the dedication of the students, made their education experience so beautiful and very authentic. It was an honor to have the opportunity to witness such powerful moments. Another comment, the small room blew my mind as well as my other classmates, since back at home we must have space for the children and we must make sure we follow A to Z in protocols. One thing that struck out for sure is that these children don't need space. They had all the room in the world for singing, learning and dancing. Whatever space they had was enough for them to do what they wanted. It was refreshing to walk into the small classrooms and be greeted with all the smiles. Despite the limited resources and space given to them, the children seemed eager to learn, and the way in which the teachers interacted with the students was amazing. One can tell just how much those teachers care about their students and are giving them a proper education. So again, the scarcity of resources didn't seem to be much of a barrier, an obstacle in what the teaching and learning that was going on. With little to no school supplies or even a proper classroom for the preschoolers, the children were all still so eager to learn. They craved knowledge, and that was such a humbling experience. Surrounded by all these beautiful little faces, I could not help but think about all of those children back home who complain about going to school, even college students who have complained their entire lives about school. It seems to have become habitual. I now believe it is not about the school itself. It is about the teacher-student relationship. Supplies are not needed to engage the imagination and creativity in children. These children would always be etched in my memory, motivating me in all of my future academic endeavors. If they can manage with so little, I definitely have nothing to complain about. So again, you know, you could see that these were almost like shifts in worldviews and shifts and transformative experiences. So on the very first day that we met, we went around and said, say one word that captures your state of mind and perceptions on India on the very first day now. And these are some of the words they came up with: bipolar, overwhelming, burns, natural, food, urban, thick, surprising, vibrant, fascinating, similar, comfortable. And then we did the same thing on the very last day that they were there. And you can see the difference. It goes from the surface elements of culture and the surface, experiencing a culture at the surface, to experiencing to a deeper, more transformative understanding of a culture. Emotionally inspired, awoken, spirituality, humility, family, motivational, satisfying, transformed, culturally rich, bittersweet, friendship, comfort. So you can, right there you see the difference. And that's what a study abroad does, is it takes you from the surface levels of culture and gives you an opportunity to experience the deeper levels of culture. Now why? So we come to the implications, and why is this important and how does that help? And because it's education, this was a course in education and we're talking about educators, I'm going to talk about the implications in education and implications for educators. Now just to give you a very brief idea of the New York City schools and the Department of Education that our students are teachers in and will be teaching in, the diversity of the schools, the diversity of the classrooms is like mind-blowing in New York City. This is from the DOE web pages. There are about 1.5 million students who attend New York City public schools, and 43% of them are reported to speak a language other than English. That's a high number. It's almost half the number of students in New York City. Now, ELLs, which are English language learners, which means students who speak whose home language is not English and they are learning English in schools, they account for 14.3%. And out of this 14.3%, which is almost 140,000 children in public schools, out of this, almost 50% of those are foreign-born. So they have just recently come into the country. So, and then 51% of ELLs are U.S.-born, but they still speak another language at home. So just to give you a sense that the children our teachers are going to be interacting with in the classrooms are so culturally diverse. Their languages are so diverse, and because the languages are diverse, their cultures are diverse. Why? Because culture and language are very closely linked. We use language to make sense of our cultures. We use to kind of conceptualize the world, to give meaning to the world, to who we are, our cultural ideas and beliefs. It comes out as a language. So culture and language are very closely intertwined. We think when we talk in a language, we are actually talking in a cultural format. I mean, it's a culture that we are talking about. So that is why it's important for teachers to be culturally competent, because they are dealing with so many culturally diverse children in their classrooms that we want them to be aware of as many different cultural situations and beliefs and values as possible. I skipped this slide just to kind of go to the next one, but these are the top 10 most prevalent home languages of students in New York City schools. And three of these 10 are from the Indian subcontinent: Bengali, Urdu, Punjabi. I'm going to very quickly try to end this so we can have a discussion. But some of the other implications of enhanced cultural awareness for educators are then when teachers are teaching about different cultures, they will try to avoid the pitfalls that often come when you're presenting culturally diverse materials. Many times there are dangers, these four dangers, like stereotyping or just, you know, triviality, political bias, incompleteness. And what does this mean? Stereotyping is when you take one aspect of a culture and exaggerate it, and that becomes a defining aspect of culture. That becomes like a stereotypical image. And that's not really true. I mean, you can't stereotype a culture based on one image. And so we have to be careful that we give them multiple images of a culture, not just one exaggerated understanding. Triviality. What's cool? What's cool? Oh, this is cool. It's a fad. I mean, everything becomes trivial. It's not. It becomes a token. It's like tokens of a culture without really understanding the importance of that token. Why do people use that? The dot here. You know, Indian women wear this. The bindi. It's fashionable now, and I see people going around wearing bindis. But it means something to Indians, and you have to try to understand that. And as a teacher, when you're teaching students, that's the deeper level you have to go to when you're presenting cultures, when you're trying to teach another culture. That it's the what of the culture that you see and how it's done, but that has to go hand in hand with the why of the culture, the explanation of why it is done the way it is done, why people behave the way they behave, why they talk the way they talk. So it has to go hand in hand. Unless we understand the deeper levels and explain that to our students, we're not really teaching them about that particular culture. Political bias. Sometimes we teach them about certain aspects of the culture. Now, there may be political meanings attached to different aspects of culture, but as outsiders, we may not understand or may not be aware of those political meanings. So inadvertently, if we teach them certain aspects of a culture, we are teaching them certain politics about one kind of politics about that culture without really paying attention to other kinds of politics. So inadvertently, we teach children political bias. And then incompleteness. For instance, someone teaching something about the Middle East and, talks about the Muslim population and the Muslim culture, the Islamic culture. But the Middle East is not just the Islamic culture. That's incomplete representation of the Middle East. There's a Christian culture and there is a Jewish culture in the Middle East. So if we just take one part of a culture to teach, it's incomplete. And that's the danger of not really doing a good job in teaching a new culture to children as teachers. So when you have a deeper understanding of a culture, you tend to then avoid these pitfalls. And the last slide I want to share with you is how other ways in which it helps to have a deeper awareness of culture for educators and school administrators is that educators may more actively seek to increase the representation of diverse students in all classrooms. They may work diligently and contentiously to provide an environment that is culturally responsive. They ensure that culture is reflected in the curriculum, including theories, research, readings. So they make sure that it's an inclusive selection of readings and theories. They increase their commitment to equity. They have more positive and productive relationships with culturally diverse students in their classrooms and their families. They can be more confident in dealing with race-related issues and incidents in school settings. And they can expand efforts to increase the diversity of their staff. The administrators, school leaders, can make a deliberate effort to expand diversity, and the school leaders can also increase their efforts to provide staff with multicultural training and preparation. And all this will happen once they understand why it is important to have a deeper understanding of culture. So I'm going to end with this last reflection from one of my students. In the beginning, I was definitely on edge as I experienced a new country and a different way of life. However, I can now truthfully say that I have come to accept and even grow comfortable with the way things are. It's refreshing in a way, and there is a sense of life that I cannot quite explain. Maybe it's because I had become so used to the same routine back home, or maybe it's the sheer structured order that I'm used to. What I find is that New Delhi is literally the complete opposite of what I've gotten used to. Rather than structured order, I find structured chaos, which breathes life into the surroundings. So thank you for that. And we're going to open it up for questions and discussions. And I want to invite my three students to come up in front so that I would like you to also respond to some of the questions. So do you have questions or comments? And we can just have a group discussion. Hi.
My interest is...
Can you tell us your name and where you're from, yes, what your background is?
I'm a professor at BMCC.
Okay.
And my interest is one day to do this. So I'd like to understand from the perspective of the students the time commitment, the money commitment, and how CUNY handled the credits and things like that. So you had to kind of fit it into, I guess, your curriculum or whatever, and you had to handle it financially, and then you had to have the time. I was interested, how much time did it involve, and did you get any assistance financially? You know, how good is CUNY in putting all that together as a package?
I guess I'll go first. Okay, so when I decided I wanted to do this, it was early on in the summer of last year. And I knew that, you know, financial aid wouldn't cover through CUNY, wouldn't cover for this study abroad. It's not for my major, so they wouldn't cover it. So what I did, I worked. I worked all summer. I saved up every single dollar. You have to pay CUNY tuition, program costs. There's a lot of fees that goes into it. But, you know, I was determined, so I really, really saved up for it. But it was pretty good. It covered everything, including living costs, food, travel expenses. It covered a lot, including international insurance. So I felt like it was worth it, you know. So
yeah, from my personal experience, my major is international studies. So whatever study abroad program you take, it kind of falls into what you want to do. Since I'm not an education major, in this class of education, they fit it. They were able to fit it in my my credits. So my advisor was able to try and fit it into my CUNY stuff. So it was able to go through, and I worked personally, so I had savings saved up, and I was able to just pay for my expenses. And for me, it was more of like I chose to do it on a whim. I didn't have like time to do it. I saw it in an email that the CUNY, because CUNY does give emails to like all the events that are coming up and everything. So from that experience, I just saw the email, quickly put my application in and did the work that I needed to do.
I'm a graduate student, so I've been paying my graduate classes. So instead of taking two classes, I decided to take this class because we had the option to take it in campus, but I decided to take it in India. Obvious reason, right. I wanted to experience it, learn about culture somewhere else. But it was an easy process, the visa, everything, because we got emails from the professor and from the chairperson.
We have a study abroad office at City College, and they really take care of the logistics in the technical aspects of it, the administration of the program. So, you know, they give help with applying for visas and all of that.
We're alone in the process. Yeah.
Another thing I should note is that somebody like me or even Megan, we're not education majors. Our departments, it might have made it, for my personal experience, my department made it really hard for me to go on this study abroad trip. And I had to come to accept the fact that the credits that I earned from this would not be counted towards my major. So I did think a lot about that, But it's something I wanted to do so badly that, you know, I told my dean that said, you know what, I'm going to go anyway. You can't stop me because I'm paying out of my own pocket. You know, financial aid is not covering. And once you tell them that, they can't say no. So you just have to accept the fact that, you know, you're not, the credit's not going to go. But once you accept that, you know, I think it's fine.
How many credits and how long?
Okay, so this was a 3-credit course. It was for 2 weeks. It was during the January break. So usually CUNY students, we have a whole month off during that time. So it was the perfect opportunity. So it didn't affect my studies as an engineer student. I thought it was the perfect time, so I went for it.
Yeah, many of us stayed extra time. Claudia and I stayed extra time, and other students stayed extra time afterwards. So we got to experience more than what the curriculum offered us.
So it's a pretty good exchange, 2 weeks, 3 credits.
Yeah, it was great.
Other comments, questions? Yeah.
How safe did you feel there? I mean, there was that one event for New Year's, and I'd like for the women to talk about whatever happened. But I know you were there as a group. I presume you were together most of the time. But I'm just curious, like, what was your actual experience? How safe did you? I know she said, the professor said that you were welcome very often in the classroom setting. But elsewhere, can you just give a few examples of how you felt?
At the beginning, it was very hard. I felt like the way you were thinking, so many men, I'm by myself. And we had to take, he was the only man, so we were like, someone up everywhere to buy this and buy that. But by the last day, we had a lot of time. And actually, we went by ourselves. Megan and I went to see the Indian Gate, you had breakfast, and we didn't really put mine.
We
also trained many
on
men.
By ourselves, and we didn't have. It wasn't. What happened on New Year's, I believe, was because it was New Year's Eve.
Right.
And it was like late at night,
right.
And people were drinking, you know. So, and it was just like young, it was a young crowd of people. So that's another reason why. On a daily basis, I didn't feel any, like, I didn't feel unsafe. I didn't feel like I had to look over my shoulder most of the time. It was just like, get your stuff done. Everybody has their own thing that they're doing. Nobody's out there to like, oh, you're an American, let me try. No, everybody has like their own schedule, their own life to deal with. So I didn't feel unsafe to work. Originally I'm from Honduras. So that's also a thing where I'm just like, I'm not unscathed by like the American views of, oh, I'm not from here, I'm foreign, and I should be more safe. No, I didn't have that thing. But it wasn't an unsafe environment. We were all welcomed in different areas, and like people always were like really nice to us, and wherever we went, restaurants, played, stores, we took the train, nobody ever bothered us on the train. We even went to Chandni Chowk afterwards.
You went to Chandni Chowk?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And that was basically it was a stop on the train. It was like a marketplace, but it was this huge marketplace. You could barely see the streets with how many people were there. And we were first, like, we were like shocked of how many people, but even there we were still fine.
Three women.
Yeah, it was 3 of us. It was 3 girls.
I'm impressed. See, a lot of the stuff, I don't know what they did.
So, back to that night on New Year's, when we went to the party village, it's called Hoskos Village, the sheer density of the crowd was overwhelming. We could not move. So, obviously, the women in our group, they were getting groped and whatnot. Guys, they had no shame in that time, because, you know, they just... I don't know.
But it wasn't every girl. It was just one or two of the girls that, and they were just like trying to in depth go into these areas where it was like you obviously can't pass because there's so many people. So you're gonna get touched in some way.
We just couldn't move, so we actually had to turn back. But when we came back a few days later, it was fine.
It's just the New Year's vibe.
Yeah,
it's the New Year energy that, you know. Yeah.
There's one more thing I want to touch on: the New Delhi traffic and walking. Okay, so when we first got there, so there's not really any developed sidewalks, so you're walking right alongside the traffic. So cars and rickshaws, motorcycles, they're coming within inches.
Brushing past you.
They can brush you. And I remember the first day, we were all like on edge, but by the time we got to the end, well, personally, by the end of the first week, yeah, we were just walking, no problem, and crossing the street, and, you know, You can't be, the secret is you can't be scared, you can't be hesitant. They will stop. They do stop. most of the time.
Do you think since all three of you could pass off as Indians, it was easier for you to blend in compared to somebody maybe who's, you know, like blonde or something? Because if you walked on the streets, it, like at first glance, nobody's going to presume that you're not Indian.
Claudia and I were, it was more of like easier for us because we were like able to like go into like different areas and like nobody really stopped on us. Like, because we're not like blonde hair, blue-eyed people, so like, they wouldn't like look at us too. They'll look at us like she's dressed like not from here, but it's fine. With him, it was even easier for him. But with his camera,
he stood out a mile because he had this big camera everywhere. Yeah.
Okay, so about that, true. I did have a camera for when we went on our trips and whatnot. But it's when I had my own personal time. I put down the camera. I put down my bag. Just me, I'm walking, and they don't even look at me. I blend completely in. And, back to what the professor said about the fees, the tourist fees and New Delhi citizen fees, I got it as a New Delhi citizen. And, it was great. I only paid 30 rupees.
Heritage?
I'm actually Guyanese, from South America. My family's from South America, but Indian ancestry. So, yeah.
So nobody questioned you at
all? Nobody questioned you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Until you open your mouth, nobody would know that.
They were more surprised that I did not speak Hindi, to be honest.
Yeah, a lot of the times, I went to the salon, because the salons are really cheap there, so I went to do my hair. And the guy sat me down, and he was talking in Hindi. I just looked, but I didn't know he was talking to me personally. And then he's washing my hair, and he said something to me, and I was just quiet and kept trying to ask me, and I was like, speak English only. And he was like, do you want tea? And I was like, okay, yes. okay, like they first off, they'll come up to you in Hindi. And I was like,
because you could pass off as Indian, that was my impression.
There's so much diversity in Indian features, I mean, there's so many different racial reflections in the Indian population. Anything from the Northeast, which, very Asian, East Asian features, to South, very African features, to the North, very Caucasian features. There's so much diversity that until you speak, you don't really know whether, Yeah, of course.
So I was just wondering, now that you guys have been back for a few months, what has changed? Your views, your daily practices, what has changed in the way you live your day-to-day lives or the way you view the world?
Okay, so in the last few slides where the professor gave the words, describing how we felt, my word at the end was bittersweet. That was my word. Okay, I did not want to leave. And when I came back, it's still ongoing. But anyway, New York City, I've grown up here. I've been here my whole life. I was born here. But, I've become so used to this place that I see it as a bland society, a bland place now. Like, New Delhi has this vibrancy that I just love, and I need to go back for that. So, and also, there's a lot of, a lot of my friends, people have their own stereotypes about the way other cultures are, how they're presented, how people live in other countries. And, when you come back from a country such as India, New Delhi, you really start to see those stereotypes that people have, especially when you talk to them about a certain subject. So those things really become clear to you. And you start really trying to avoid those stereotypes. You try to live your life in a more humble way, I guess you can say. Because New Delhi, I think it really humbled all of us with what we experienced there.
Yeah, and talking about the stereotypes, you can also open the eyes of the people who have those stereotypes. And you're like, listen, I was there for the entire month, like I know. And it made me more motivated in my schooling. Because, like, looking at those children in a 6x6 classroom, it's like, what do I have to complain about? Like, okay, the internet sometimes is not up, but, like, I'll get by in an hour. Like, so there's no reason. So I don't find that excuse anymore to where I'm, like, feeling overwhelmed with schoolwork and having to deal with. I'm just like, hey, this is what I have to do to get by, and it's okay.
For me, I guess it got me to find a way when it comes to everything. I'm a teacher too. So for me, before, it used to be like, oh, I don't have this. I don't have color ink. I don't have enough space. And now it's like, oh, so I have this. How about I use this to get to replicate what will be something from like color printing? So I get to find different ways. I get to try different ways to get what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wanted to ask you, which was the NGO that specifically was teaching women to read and write? The newspaper?
Yeah.
And the other question I wanted to ask him is, because you said your ancestors were originally from India, did you feel like you were finally connecting with who you are? Those were the two.
Okay. Yeah. You want to answer?
No, you go ahead. Answer her question first, then I'll.
Okay. Yes. I even found out where exactly my heritage is from, Uttar Pradesh. So, yes, I felt very connected. Even more so than my Guyanese roots. I feel way more connected to my Indian ancestry now.
Hmm. So the NGO is called Nirantar. Nirantar, which means it's an endless cycle, continuous. That's what it means. And the newspaper that they produced was Khabar Lehriya.
And what language?
I think they said in 7 different regional languages they
so
produced that.
Northwest? Like, where are they located? Like, is it like Punjabi, Hindi, etc.?
Well, the main office is in Delhi, so it's around the villages around New Delhi. Yeah.
So it would be Hindi,
yeah.
Punjabi.
Yeah, English. Yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah.
I was curious, going back to the issue of safety. There's some countries where you have to because you're a foreigner, you have to safeguard all your technology, you have to safeguard your wallets because of pickpockets or thieves.
Here too.
Yeah.
Right,
yes.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, is that prevalent, obvious, or not?
Actually, some of you had the reverse. Yeah, go ahead. Both of you.
Both of you. Okay, so let me touch on before we even went on the trip. So, you know, before I even went on, so many people were telling me, oh, be careful, pickpockets, people are going to rob you, this, that, a whole bunch of nonsense. Anyway, when we actually got there, people are so friendly that, you know, of course, in any place you go, you have to safeguard your belongings. But, you know, people over there, you know, they have their own phones and stuff. Why would they want ours? So anyway, so after a particularly long night, I accidentally left my phone in a certain place. And I went back to my hotel, and by the time I got back to my hotel, I'm looking for my phone, it's not there. So this other place that I went to, I didn't know where it was, so I didn't know how I was going to get my phone back. I was getting ready to accept the fact that I lost my phone, that's it, you know. But, you know, a person from that place, the administration in that place, they actually went on my phone, they went into my WhatsApp, through my contacts, they actually managed to contact members of our group, and members of the group got back to me, and then I got into a rickshaw with a gentleman who did not speak any English whatsoever, and he actually helped. He didn't know. All I knew was that this place was located in a place called New Friends Colony, and I did not know how to get there, so I asked the rickshaw driver, oh, can you take me so-and-so to this place in the New Friends Colony, and he didn't understand me. So I just showed him a paper. He didn't know where the address was, but he helped me. We went around to different locals, and he got out of his rickshaw and helped me. He asked the people where this place was, and we got there. Mm-hmm. And he waited for me to get my stuff, and then we got it back. People are very friendly over there. I got my phone back in a place where I never expected to get it back. Mm-hmm. So I think that says a lot, really. The stereotypes that people have of over there are completely wrong. So.
And what was your experience?
I went to the salon, and I left my phone. I didn't even realize I left my phone until someone came and they were like, "Is this your phone?" I'm like, "Yes." I'm like, "Yeah." I didn't even realize I left it. I have my phone stolen here in New York, but there
So where, how did they come to you after you left?
I have my picture as a people.
We're still at the salon.
Yeah.
Oh, you were still at the salon. Okay. Okay. So that answers your question, right?
And just to add on to that, the study abroad office at the City College also gives orientation to students, like a pre-departure orientation. And something they tell them is like, and they do the same thing for students going to like any country, like don't take a camera.
Right.
And I remember when they said that, like, I took a class in Mexico and I was like, what? How would you even go without a camera? Yeah. Like that's, don't not take a camera. That's crazy.
Yeah. Right? Oh, we take our camera and we're taking pictures even, you know, where we live. So it's become so like taking pictures on a cell phone. Right.
I do have a question about the 25%.
That's
fascinating. And then I kind of made this connection to when you guys were saying how foreigners have to pay a certain rate and you're treated better.
Right.
So my question is, these students who are in this 25%, first of all, I doubt that it's really 25% at this point, right? They're still finding out about it, right? But how are they treated?
It gets filled up really quickly.
So how are they treated in schools by peers, by educators?
Yeah. So that's a whole, there's been a whole, because they started this about 5 or 6 years ago, and they've now tried to do some studies on, in the beginning it was very difficult. It was a huge challenge for, I mean, at all levels, you know, the children didn't know. Their codes of behaviors in, say, the private school are completely different. So they were, you know, taking away cell phones, and they were taking away video, things that they had never seen before, they were taking from their classmates, and, you know, parents were bringing them back. Families who were more affluent in the classroom frowned upon their children playing with, you know, children who came from poorer families. The teachers, so children who came from poor families, the language is a big, the English language is a big issue because in private schools, language of instruction is English. And so children who come in without knowing English at all, I mean, the teachers didn't know how to teach in any other method. And they didn't know how to read, you know, like we have bilingual education. They're not trained in that. So that the teachers, it was challenging for the teachers to teach these children because they didn't understand what was going on. So there were all kinds of challenges. But, so initially they had these studies which showed that it was not working at all. But over time, I think it's really, and we actually observed some of the things. You want to talk about how there was, we went to a classroom where the child didn't know English.
Yeah,
and
we went to a private school. I don't remember exactly what the name of the private school was, but they were elementary children, and they had the class of their children and then the children from the slum as well, and those kids who didn't speak Hindi would answer. They would all eagerly try to answer the questions, but they wouldn't answer in English, so the teacher would say, okay, this word, does anybody know what it means in English? And all, since it's like a second language to these kids, they all knew. So it wouldn't make the kid feel not discriminated against, but like ostracized.
Yeah.
And they just made it into an integral thing where it was like, okay, what color is this? And the kid didn't know the color in English. They would say, okay, it's Mila or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, what color is this in English? And some of the kids would answer. So it was like an intertwined thing. And they also had offices where they would bring in the children and sit with the families and try to get them as close to their peers as possible in like academics. So that was also a thing where they tried to, like, it was a, they had like methods, like they were trying to bring these kids up to the same way as the other ones and not like neglecting them.
So it was a big challenge and a lot of effort put into place in educating parents, both parents, the affluent parents as well as the, you know, the poor parents, because the schools, I mean, this was a law. It had to be done. So the schools are faced with, okay, we have to make this work. What can we do to make it work? And so they had to put in a lot of, you know, parent education classes and workshops, a lot of remedial education for the children to help them come up. And like she said, it was really, you can't make out. When you go enter a classroom, you don't know which student is which. But when the teacher asked a question, first of all, it's unbelievable. Everybody is like raring to answer. No matter what class you go to, what school you go to, they just want to answer. Like the teacher just has to ask a question and they want to answer the question, which is like so energizing to see that. So they all put up their hands, and the teacher will pick on someone, okay, what is the answer? And the child would answer in Hindi, which is the language she knows. And then the teacher would just say, okay, that's good. And so how would we say it in English? So, you know, without making the child feel it. So I personally was really very impressed with the way they're handling things. Things are not smooth as yet, but I think people have their heart in the right place and they want to make this work.
How old was the law?
The policy was made into law just in 2010. So it's barely like, it's just been the last five, six years that it's really being implemented now. But the population, because of the population, those seats fill up quickly. Just that many families don't know that they can apply. So applying for something doesn't mean you're guaranteed a seat because there's, you know, it's so limited. Even the 25% is so limited. Yeah. An incoming class, yeah. And a class size there is 40. We went to schools which had 40 children in the classroom. Yeah, 43-year-olds.
One teacher?
Two teachers for the nursery and kindergarten, and then one teacher after that.
So that was also in, you know, let's say in the New Delhi. If you go in the rural,
oh, yes, six,
one teacher,
yes,
100 is
good. Yes, yes, there are 60, 70. That, an average class size across the country is 60. Thank you. What's the time, Anthony? We should wrap up? Okay, well, we'll wrap up then. But thank you so much. Thank you. It was great.